one of the very important events in intellectual history in the 18th century was the Lisbon earthquake. Now that sounds rather strange to us, in that in the past century we have seen a number of far more serious earthquakes in various parts of the world, natural disasters such as the eruption of Mount Pelée, without having any impact on intellectual history. But the Lisbon earthquake was a very important event in intellectual history, and some studies, books, monographs have been written about its impact. Why did an earthquake have so great an impact? The reason for it was that the 18th century, as a result of the Enlightenment, had come to magnify the role of reason to the point that reason and God had been identified, and reason and nature had been identified. What prevailed in Protestantism and in Catholicism at that time was not orthodoxy on the whole, but rather what was called rational religion. So that God was extensively identified with reason. And every emphasis was made on the rationality of reason and the rationality of God's operation. I cited in one of the earlier lectures the fact that John Locke had much earlier declared that the reason for the necessity of the Bible, of revelation, was that in those earlier ages, men being less rational, God had to give them the Bible. However, now that mankind had reached so exalted a state, it no longer needed revelation. It had the full, clear light of reason. Now, outside of the churches, the philosophes, the men of the Enlightenment, had discarded God and religion and substituted for God nature. Nature with a capital N. And nature for them was identical with reason. And therefore, there was a correlation for them between the logic of their mind and this ideal concept of nature. And along came the Lisbon earthquake. Totally irrational. And the result for both churches and the philosophers, the rationalists, was devastating. Neither God nor the natural order responded to their idea of right reason. If I were where I could readily pull shelves off of my library, I would bring you a book on the Lisbon earthquake and cite various reactions to it. But as a very poor substitute, I shall read a few sentences from a book I am at present reading, The Romantic Rebellion by Kenneth Clark. And very early in this book, Clark feels, of course, as he explains the revolt against classicism and reason in art, the centrality in that revolt of the Lisbon earthquake. And I quote, "Readers of Voltaire's Candide will remember how the smooth surface of common sense optimism was cracked by the Lisbon earthquake of 1755. It was the 18th century equivalent of the sinking of the Titanic. It was much more, actually. The immediate effect of the earthquake was extraordinary. Madame de Pompadour gave up Rouge for a week. She has offered it up, said Horace Walpole, to the demon of earthquakes. And for a fortnight, the stakes wagered at White's were substantially reduced. Never before, said Gaty, who was six at the time, has the demon of fear so quickly and so powerfully spread horror throughout the land. Suddenly it became clear to man that reason was not entirely in control, and that in fact reason was not that important in nature. That nature seemed to go its own way with a great deal of the irrational, and they had, as it were, been living on an earthquake, on a volcano, and ignoring the fact that it was under them. The effect of this was devastating. Moreover, it was very unsettling to men in particular. The women's lib people have a rather distorted view of past history when they feel that women had a very subordinate role throughout the centuries. As a matter of fact, in the Christian era, women had quite a high position. The medieval merchant, who often traveled a great distance with a considerable amount of difficulty, normally found that there was one person he could trust to manage his business, his wife. The Renaissance only accentuated the independence of women. The Elizabethan era certainly showed a very prominent role of women in national life. The Puritan movement strengthened the position of women. This was especially true in America. Consider, for example, the situation in New England, where women reached a position of enormous power. So many men, both merchant seamen as well as ordinary seamen, would be overseas for 6 months, occasionally 3 years. Who handled the farm, the shop, the business in their absence? The woman did. And her knowledge of economics, of bookkeeping, of pricing, and so on, had to be good, or while her husband was away, the business could go under. As a result, women had a tremendous amount of economic power, a great deal of practical business knowledge. They knew how to run and manage businesses, farms, manufacturing enterprises, and very commonly did so. The position of women only began to fade in this country after about 1800. Earlier, a century earlier, it had begun to collapse in Europe, especially after 1660. What was the reason for the collapse of the position of women into the role of dolls, as it were? The Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, with its ideas of reason, developed a very peculiar psychology whereby it saw men as the epitome of reason, of rationality, and women as irrationality, and the strong aspect of women being faith, trust, dependence. As a result of this view, it progressively subordinated women, legally and socially. Moreover, because religion involved faith, why, religion became the province of women. And we are still under the influence of this kind of thinking. It is assumed that the church and religion is the duty and the area of women. And by and large, across the world, women predominate in membership in the churches, with one single exception, the Mormons. Now, women being regarded as irrational, they were progressively eliminated from the business world. Their legal rights were progressively withdrawn. And they were either put on a pedestal or regarded with fear as a part of that horrible world of the irrational. And as a result, you have, among philosophers and others, this strange ambivalence, the love-hate relationship with regard to women, regarding them as monsters, the thing to be feared when you go into woman, take your whip, or else idolizing them as Comte did, who carried on a religion of worshiping his ex-mistress and virtually invented a church in her honor. But by and large, the relationship was one of distrust, of fear. Man as reason now, because reason had left the outer world. Reason did not belong in God, or if he existed, or in nature. Reason was only here in the mind of man. And around him was a vast world of unreason. And then he was compelled to confront unreason in his life. This was a horrible thing. And so the philosophers began to regard women as a dread figure, something to be feared. Women now became a symbol of the world of nature, irrational, dangerous, volcanic, ready to erupt all over you at any time. And if you were to talk to the average man nowadays, he would give you that image of woman. Of course, he can blow up all the time, and that's pure reason when he blows up. He is rationally motivated in his temper tantrums, but not the woman, you see. By definition, never. The world of unreason was represented in woman. Ideas, you see, have consequences. They are not only an academic discipline, but a plan for living. Most abstract ideas within a very few years become marching orders for civilization. Now, one of the consequences of the Lisbon earthquake was that nature no longer could be seen as the area of law, of reason. The idea of nature as the area of law and reason was finally totally subverted by Darwin, who reduced nature to simply an area of chance variation. Impossible to ascribe reason to that. But the Lisbon earthquake began that shattering. And then one thinker, very logically, very ruthlessly, took that idea and carried it to its logical conclusion. The Marquis de Sade, S-A-D-E, from whom we have the name of perversion, the perversion sadism. De Sade's dates were 1740 to 1814. It's an interesting and a very, very revealing fact that 25 years ago, in every civilized country, the works of Sade were prohibited from publication. They were universally regarded as about the worst, the most pornographic, the most degenerate things ever written by any man. Since then, they have not only been published all over the world, but very highly praised. The collected works, the volumes in English, published in this country, are big, thick volumes, the introductions to which are of book length themselves. And the men and women who write the introductions constitute a catalog of great names, essentially in the existentialist movement. A large number of biographies have been written about the sonnet. The title of one of these is very revealing, The Divine Marquis. From the abominable Marquis, he has become the Divine Marquis. He has been called the great psychologist of the modern age. He has been called the most profound of existentialists, the father of the modern age, and a great many other things. Why? Well, before we go into the Marquis' thinking, just a brief note about his life. Because of his perverted activities, sadistic activities, he was very early imprisoned during the reign of Louis XVI. The storming of the Bastille, which began the French Revolution, was really incited by the Marquis de Sade. He was a prisoner on the Bastille. Only a handful of prisoners were in the institution. I believe there were 14 only. It was really a relic of the past. Their role was a very comfortable one. The Marquis was able to write and to live in relative comfort. But when the disorders began in Paris, the Marquis de Sade began to shout from the window about how he was being imprisoned and persecuted and tortured for liberty. And so the inflamed mobs stormed the Bastille to free the Marquis de Sade. He was one of the first heroes of the revolution. But then the revolution found him intolerable and imprisoned him. Later he became free again in the new order and was imprisoned by Napoleon. He spent a good deal of his life in prison. Some of the Marquis's present-day champions say, well, the legal history of his offenses is not so very great. We have many numbers of people who are doing the same thing nowadays, which is true enough. We can also say that any study of the France of Louis XV, and note I say Louis XV, not Louis XVI, who was of a different character and lost his head for the sins of his fathers. In the reign of Louis XV, every kind of degeneracy and perversion was routine. The court was cynical. It ascribed to what we now call the new morality and maintained a facade for the world of sanctimonious piety so that no one would be offended. The difference, however, was this. What these men of the court did as a secret sin, Sade declared to be the new virtue. This constitutes today the difference between the old pornography and the new. I have a book coming out from Arlington Press on the 3rd of September entitled The Politics of Pornography, in which I trace, to a degree I cannot begin to touch this afternoon, the implications of Sade's philosophy in the modern world. But I point out at the very beginning that the old pornography was self-consciously written as dirty books. The new pornography is self-consciously written as the healthy books for the liberation of man. We fail to understand the new pornography if we do not realize that it presents itself as the new idea of health and of liberation. And this it derives from Sade. And hence the importance of Sade to us today, as well as an understanding of Sade. Sade's philosophical premise was very simple. We encounter it again in the first Kinsey Report of the 1950s. Saad said that since for us, by definition, God is ruled out of court, and we derive our standard from nature, anything that occurs in nature is by definition natural and normal. And anything designed to suppress that which is in nature is unnatural. Therefore, the philosophers have all been wrong, Saad held, in that they say, well, here are certain things in terms of right reason we must do and which we must not do. Nature, he said, gives us no ground for condemning anything. As a result, Saad's work is a prolonged defense of every kind of perversion and its total right. For example, Saad said, the urge to rape women is normal with me. What is wrong is for a woman to frustrate me when I'm trying to rape her, because this constitutes an unnatural act, a violation of a natural urge. And we must not frustrate nature. That which is in nature and is impelled, an urge created by nature, is by definition right. Now, Alexander Pope had stated this philosophy somewhat earlier, but had not dared to apply it. Whatever is right. Whatever is right. We have had in our recent years a great folk hero of the New Left, Lenny Bruce, who again formulated this philosophy. His formulation was summed up in his words, truth is what is. A lie is everything, he went on to say, that tries to frustrate what is. And therefore, every urge that exists in nature has an absolute right. Every attempt to frustrate it is a lie. Now, the first Kinsey report, for example, had a considerable section on child molesting. What was the conclusion of it? There was nothing wrong with molesting little girls. The damage was done by parents and teachers and clergymen who taught little girls that there was something wrong with being molested. When if they didn't fill the child's mind with such garbage, it could be a very meaningful experience. Now, it's interesting that there were no critics of that point in Kinsey's work. A great many scientists criticized the statistical basis of the report, the method of gathering data. But they did not criticize this aspect. The only one who came close to it was a psychoanalyst, a very brilliant man, Dr. Edmund Bergler, B-E-R-G-L-E-R. Nature's rule, as the Enlightenment had imagined it, had been broken. First of all, epistemology had led to the end of nature as such, as an overall unity in favor of fleeting sense impressions. And the mind had replaced nature as an organizing factor. And Kant was later to say that the mind provides structure, not nature. The things in themselves are beyond knowability. Later on, Darwin was to reduce nature to chance variations and hence purposeless and structureless, with no fixity of species. All this, however, was implicit and in the air. Darwin did not create a revolution. He simply capped it. The mythology has it that when Darwin published his books, there was a great hue and outcry of protest from Victorian England. The reality is, the book was greeted so joyfully that the entire first printing of that scientific work sold out on the day of printing. One bishop opposed it. Queen Victoria, by the way, was very happy. Why? She didn't have to believe some of those horrible Old Testament stories. Queen Victoria, by the way, was not as Victorian as people assumed she was. When she was a young girl, nude bathing was commonplace on the beaches of England. We have a very distorted picture of Victorianism. The Victorian styles were not motivated by modesty, but by a desire to tease. If I may digress there a moment, the hoop skirt was one of the most immodest kinds of style because it was a teaser par excellence. Not only was there a low neckline with that type of dress, but consider what a hoop skirt meant. If the woman bent over, why, the hoop skirt went up and she exposed everything. And it was very commonplace for the Victorian woman to bend over for some reason or other to pet a little dog or something. It was a style designed to have the maximum effect as a teaser. Victorianism is, to a great extent, a myth. Well, that's a digression, but... And during the Victorian era, London, by the way, was the pornography capital of the world. Somebody ought to write a revised opinion of what Victorianism was. Now, Sod's idea that whatever is in nature is normative has become, of course, the philosophy of our time. Very shortly after the publication of Sod in the beginning of the 50s, you had the rise of the Beatnik movement. Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl. And the thesis of Howl was simply this: everything that is holy. And he goes on to recite, holy is the homosexual, holy is the pimp, holy is the prostitute, holy is everything. Everything in nature, you see, now, every urge in nature is normative. What is wrong is to condemn it. The hippies of the 60s carried this idea further. Today, of course, Sod's ideas, without being labeled as Sodian, are on every talk show all over the country. And on some of the women's lib talk-in shows in Southern California, the discussion nowadays, I understand, I've never listened to these, but every now and then I check with some women friends who do, just to see what's happening. The big thing on these talk-in shows is having a live-in. What's a live-in? Well, it's a man you invite in for a time, and when you're through with him, you give him his walking papers and tell him to get going. And the philosophy expressed on these live-in shows is Sodian. I have tuned in for a few minutes each day on the television to see what's on. I was amazed to see there was quite a bit of pro-gold talk. I heard Harry Schultz and Dines and Brown, as well as one very anti-gold person. But I also heard someone on one of the shows, who attacked Harry Brown and the idea of a gold standard, expressed other standards, and someone in favor of, he's written a book, Is Marriage Necessary? Do Your Own Thing, which of course is Sadian in essence. Now, basic to Sad was a radical hatred of God, of any idea of law. And he has one character in one of his books say, and the character being his mouthpiece, as it were, "Ah, how many times, by God, have I not longed to be able to assail the sun, snatch it out of the universe, make a general darkness, or use that star to burn the world. Oh, that would be a crime." Unquote. Sad's writings are a long justification of evil, the right of evil to do as it pleases. Ironically, the groundwork for Sad was laid down by a very respectable writer, Montesquieu. Montesquieu, in The Spirit of Laws, made laws dependent on climate, circumstance, and physiology. He discussed the law, for example, in The Spirit of Laws in relationship to soil, to nationality, to religion, to the size of the population in a country, and other such factors. Now, Montesquieu was not thereby going into pure relativism, but Sade pushed Montesquieu's ideas into total relativism and said all our ideas are totally dependent upon purely relative factors. And therefore, there is no validity to anything. You do your own thing. Sade's own thing was sadomasochism, homosexuality, coprophilia, and so on. Coprophilia, coprothesis, and philia, love. I won't go into the details of what it means. For Sade, all acts are equally valid. Moreover, Sade formulated a doctrine which has had a powerful influence from then to the present in all of life, especially in art. And we shall deal with this doctrine and its influence on religion as well in our subsequent lectures. The doctrine of natural inspiration. Evil, he said, is a natural mandate and an inspiration. It is the infallible voice of nature which Christianity damns as original sin, he said, and which it seeks to suppress. But evil is actually, he said, a natural inspiration. It is the voice of nature within us. And so, as he has one of his characters, Delmas, who represents himself, instruct a very young girl in the new faith. He says, start from one fundamental point, Eugenie. In libertinage, nothing is frightful because everything libertinage suggests is also a natural inspiration. The most extraordinary, the most bizarre acts, those which most errantly seem to conflict with every law, every human institution. As for heaven, I have nothing to say. Well, Eugenie, even those are not frightful. And there is not one amongst them all that cannot be demonstrated within the boundaries of nature. It is certain that the one you allude to, lovely Eugenie, is the very same relative to which one finds such a strange fable in the tasteless fictions of Holy Writ. Eugenie, oh, it's natural? Delmas, yes, natural. So I affirm it to be. Nature has not got two voices, you know, one of them condemning all day long what the other commands. Now, that point, you see, was where sod backed up everybody against the wall. All those who held to the Enlightenment faith. How can you ascribe two voices to nature? One saying, thou shalt not, and the other saying, do it. If your nature urges you to commit homosexual acts or rape or anything else, that other voice is not your natural voice, it's an imposed, an artificial, a false voice. They couldn't answer to Sod. They could imprison him, but they could not answer him, since they had abandoned Orthodox Christianity. To convince ourselves, let us for an instant scrutinize both her operations and her laws. Were it that nature did naught but create and never destroy, I might be able to believe with those tedious sophists that the sublimest of all actions would be incessantly the labor of production. And following that, I should grant with them that the refusal to reproduce would perforce have to be a crime. However, does not the most fleeting glance at natural operations reveal that destructions are just as necessary to our plan as our creations? That the one and the other of these functions are interconnected and enmeshed so intimately that for either to operate without the other would be impossible? That nothing would be born, nothing would be regenerated without destructions? Destruction, hence, like creation, is one of nature's mandates, unquote. Now, in the first thing that Sod wrote, he said that he was in favor of all acts between consenting adults. The modern position, of course. But he soon realized that this was a hypocritical position. Why necessarily between consenting adults? Didn't he have also a natural instinct to kill, to rape, to murder, to do any kind of thing to anyone when he was angry at them? Why should he frustrate himself by paying attention to some kind of religious or civil law which says, thou shalt not kill? And so he asserted the right to murder. The right to murder. Because nature is normative. And so he said, the only crime is Christianity. Now, somewhat later, one of the heroes of libertarianism today, Max Stirner, in the early part of the 19th century, came to a similar conclusion. And very logically, Max Stirner and the Ego and His Own ridiculed savagely those liberals who refused to believe in God but would not commit incest to their sister or their mother. He said they are still Christians. They have not recognized that there is no law save the law of the ego. Well, much earlier, Sod had come to that conclusion. Men are necessary creatures of nature. Their nature requires fulfillment. Theft, murder, rape, every perversion, he vindicated. And he said, we listen only to nature's voice. We are fully convinced that if anything were criminal, it would be to resist the pensions nature inspires in us, rather than to come to grips with them. Unquote. Natural inspiration, he went on to say, requires us to commit every evil urge we have. Now, Sod advocated some statist measures pending the abolition of the state. He espoused infanticide, abortion, euthanasia, statist education. He was a great champion of that. He was a strong promoter of the idea that the world was overpopulated and there should be strict population control and an elimination of those who could not withstand the power of others, the survival of the fittest. If I can kill you, then I have a right to survive and you don't. That was his logic. Light was not good for Sod, because for him he saw destruction and the urge to destroy more powerful in nature than any urge to love or to create. And so Sod culminates in a will to universal death. The universe of modern man has progressively become, as a result of the logic of Sod, totally perverse, with a radical will to evil and to death. One of the very brilliant psychologists of our day, Samuel Warner, wrote a few years ago a very telling, extremely important analysis of precisely this factor in the modern world, entitled "The Urge to Mass Destruction," one of the most important books in psychology ever written, published by Gruen and Stratton, "The Urge to Mass Destruction." And indeed, this is what we have in the strain of modern philosophy. The impact of Sod on the 20th century is very great. The underground press, sexually oriented magazines for men and women, television, films, literature, all manifest Sodian traits. Increasingly, Sodian ideas are becoming very, very respectable. Recently, one national publication had an article by a doctor entitled "The Incest Urge," where he refused to pay any attention to the medical research on incest, which has demonstrated the extremely high ratio of total degeneracy in the offspring of incestuous relations, where some, in fact, do not survive beyond a few years, and the others require total hospitalization, with only a very small minority being anywhere near normals. In spite of this, Dr. Shepherd hopes that incest will soon become respectable. The sexual revolution a few years ago concentrated on making homosexuality acceptable and respectable, and they feel that they have largely gained a position of recognition for homosexuals, and now the area of great emphasis is on making incest respectable. The Sodian influence in our modern world revealed itself when, after World War II, a great hue and cry arose all over the world. And no less a man than General de Gaulle bowed to it to free a prisoner named Jean Genet, G-E-N-E-T. What was involved? Jean Genet was a professional criminal, a homosexual, a pickpocket, a very cheap hoodlum. From very early youth, he had spent his life in and out of prison as a small-time hoodlum with no desire to earn an honest living, a parasite on society. Then in prison, he began to read the books in the prison library, and suddenly a great light dawned for Genet. As a result of his study of modern intellectuals and philosophers, he said, "Why, there is no God. I never did believe in him anyway, but I know there is no God. And if there is no God, there is no crime, because there is no law in the universe. Then what am I doing in prison? What right has anybody to put me in prison and to say something is right and wrong? I'm not a criminal. I'm a member of the new order, of the new world." And so he began to write in that vein. and the philosophers of the world, the intellectuals, rallied to his support. How dare France keep a great thinker, a great philosopher in prison? And so he was freed. Not even de Gaulle could stand that assault of the intellectuals. And a very important book was written on him, a very wordy, lengthy book, by the existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre, entitled, and the title is very revealing, Saint Genet. Saint Genet. Genet as the saint of the New World Order. Well, in 1963, the book came out in the United States in translation. And almost immediately, within a matter of months, early in 64, in paperback, as a mentor book. I picked it up at the bookstore of one of the most important universities in the United States, and they didn't have it on the shelves to sell. They brought it in by the cartons and just stacked it on the floor. The demand for it was that great. And they were replacing it by bringing out carton boxes of it. The influence of Sadian thinking and Genet's thinking is very great. And as I would go from campus to campus and pick up some of the literature, it interested me in the 60s how much I would find references to Genet or to Genet characters in Genet's books. There was no question of the influence of Genet. Now for Saint Genet, liberation is first from God, then from the idea that anything is evil. Genet, says Sartre, and I quote, has killed the law. The God of Genet is Genet himself. His pure will to evil represents spirituality, unquote. Modern man, according to Sartre, must purify himself by committing evil systematically. Then only can he be a saint in the modern sense. Evil alone gives man autonomy, says Sartre. And because Genet has been much more logical and systematic than we who are philosophers, he is the saint of our world. Of course, Sartre goes on to say, this pure will to evil will lead to suffering because the people of the old order who still have either a Christian faith or a Christian hangover. You see, most of you, whether you're Christian or not, if you're not Christian, you have a Christian hangover. You still see things in moral terms. And the Christians have a hangover of the old Christian law, even though they're more or less humanistic. So we will persecute men like Genet. Just as the Christian saints were persecuted in bygone centuries, now the existentialist saints are being persecuted. And Sartre says, unquote, unless one is a god, one cannot make oneself happy without the help of the universe. To make oneself unhappy, one needs only oneself. So Sartre goes a step further. The saints after the order of Genet are going to be persecuted by us who are unhappy with their standard or lack of standard. But even more, the only way you can be happy is to have relationships with God and the universe, with man. But you cannot do that if you're an existentialist. For me, my neighbor is the devil. That's the existentialist conclusion. So, to be an existentialist, you must need only yourself. But then, to be an existentialist saint, you're going to be perpetually unhappy. Because if you're all by yourself, you are condemned to unhappiness. And so it is that almost as a badge of honor, modern existentialist youth must feel unhappy, isolated, having a communications problem, ridden with grief, alienation, anxiety, everything. Because you're not really an existentialist if you're not unhappy. You're still depending on meaningful relationships with other people, which you're not supposed to have. And then how logical it is, if your relationship to other people is sadistic. You feel that the only thing you can do is to satisfy your urge violently. For Sod, if the woman gave in and were ready, there was no pleasure in it. He detested her. It had to be an overpowering or a seduction in which she were unwilling at every step. And when she suddenly was conquered and said, "I love you," drop her. Walk away from her at that point. She would be totally undesirable. This, as a matter of fact, became very commonplace in the last century as a part of the role of the gallant, because it was love them and leave them. When you conquered, then they were no good. Of course, basic to all of this is that sense of hostility. A total war against the world, because you alone can be God. And to love anyone or to allow anyone to establish a love bond with you is to give them power over you, claim over you, which is intolerable. I said when we began that philosophy is not an academic discipline. It is a matter of life and death. And today the ideas of Sade, which were his in the Bastille, are today the ideas of our students and of the man in the street and of people who have never heard of Sade. On this talk-in show, I heard women expounding Sadean ideas and the new morality. One of them had at least the grace to say, "I hope my kids are not listening in." It has become the common coinage intellectually of our age. Are there any questions now?
What would you say are the key ideas and concepts of Christianity if you had to explain it to you?
I couldn't quite hear. What is the key idea of...
What would you say are the key concepts of Christianity? Ten Commandments, Sermon on the Mount. To explain briefly the meaning of Christianity to an existential student.
Yes. Well, that's a big order, and of course I'm not here to teach theology, but to talk about modern philosophy. But very briefly, the thing to say to an existentialist is that there is an absolute and sovereign God who has an absolute law structure throughout the universe and in every fiber of our being. That nature, including our nature, is not normative but fallen. And that the only remedy for that fallen estate is the sovereign grace of God through Christ. That's it.
Amen. interesting.
Yes.
Do all existentialists naturally fall in their axiological position to a Sadean mold?
The logic requires them to go there. Many of them choose to stop short of Sod. But their logic puts them there ultimately, and the drift towards Sod has been very great. You find favorable things said about Sod now, even by theologians. He's become suddenly a very profound thinker. In a sense, he was. Although very perverse, because he saw the logic of deifying nature, and he exploited it to the full.
I can't quite understand the concept evil by a Sadean, because it would seem to me that he would say that's not an evil, that's a natural.
True.
You understand my point?
Yes, exactly. The Sadeans are aware of this, and Sod himself was. But he uses that term because most people still are Christian intellectually, if not by profession of faith. And therefore, they will dub everything Sod does as evil. So he says, I affirm evil, I choose evil, I will do that which is evil, so that you and I may understand precisely what it is he espouses. But he affirms this to be the natural. Any other questions? Yes.
That kind of view, would this include the urge to self-destruction that we saw in the existentialist last night?
Yes.
So that can just as well follow.
Right. This is why, for example, in one of the more recent books on suicide, the right to suicide is very firmly upheld. And this was in the course of a study of this young girl, Sybil something, in England, the poetess who committed suicide a few years ago. What was her name? Yes, yes. And the book was written by Alvarez, was it not? What's the title of it? It slips me. I have the book, but I just don't recall the title. Yes.
Where does Dr. Fletcher fit in for this?
Well, Fletcher, of course, is in favor of situation ethics, and situation ethics is, to a great extent, one of the aspects of this whole current of thought. I wouldn't say it's directly Sadean, but it very definitely goes along with the idea that there is no possible, which now has been universally accepted. Sod was the pioneer. Well, let's put it this way. As far as law was concerned, it was first derived from God. Then law was derived from nature as a substitute for God. Then with Sod, there was only nature and everything in nature. Now, after Darwin, men began to feel this crisis. Law had disappeared. There had to be a law. So, in the spirit of modern philosophy, they said, we must have a source for law. And now the source, philosophically, the only tenable one, is man. Man is now the source of law. So you have the modern state, totalitarian. You have the whole of the modern world. Natural law has disappeared. Sod killed it. Effectively. You can only have status law. The implications of this, for example, came home to John Stuart Mill, who began as an old-fashioned libertarian and ended as a socialist. Because as Bill began to meditate on Darwin and everything that led to Darwin, he began to realize there is no idea of law possible from nature. Who will provide it? Why, the state must. And so Mill moved from one camp to the other. This is why conservatives who try to find their foundation in some kind of law of nature are doomed. They're fighting a rear guard battle, because in terms of the modern world, that's obsolete. The only place now you can... Assad, you see, was right. They have not been able to meet Assad head-on and answer his argument. The only way they can do it is to go back to God. Only by saying that there is a law beyond the natural realm which acts as a standard to the natural realm can you have it. Yes?
I'm not a philosophy major. I'm just curious. I mean, everything here seems to be in the context of corruption and the destruction of Christians. Mm-hmm. You know, what about what's going on in the Jewish community, you know, as far as going to go back, you know, forget
yes.
Christ, but what's going on that whole thing? I mean, the same type of corruption and destruction?
Same thing. In the Jewish community, there has been a parallel development. This strand of philosophy that I've been recounting has affected every strand of Western civilization. Now, Jewish orthodoxy was quite strong through the 18th century. It maintained its traditional position somewhat longer, but it was still very heavily infiltrated by rationalism. In the last century, it had its own, revivalistic experiential movements rise up, its liberal modernist movements, and Judaism, by and large, has been captured by humanism. So that, except for a limited minority, the Jewish thinkers of our time, the Jewish synagogues, are humanistic. There's a very brilliant minority that is against this. Dr. Kirzner at NYU is an Orthodox Jew. My memory for names today is very bad. There's a very brilliant historian who's done the most profound study of the economic situation of Europe up to the time of the Crusades from the fall of Rome. He is an Orthodox Jew, and there are a handful of them, but most of them are humanists. Well, as a consequence, they are disintegrating as a community. As of the 1960s, over one-third of the young Jews were marrying non-Jews, which meant they were going to disappear from the Jewish community. Since then, the rate has been stepped up, and so one of the problems in the Jewish community today is this. By the end of this century, which is 26 years away, they are going to have some of the most beautiful, most richly endowed synagogues in the world, all across the United States, with endowed funds and no Jews left to attend them. The disintegration is very rapid. There's a considerable amount of fallout into Christian churches, by the way. Yes?
Dr. Rushman, one more question. Do you think that the Saudian influence has been instrumental in a drive for mandatory sex education in the public school system throughout the United States?
Well, I have never studied the thinking of Mrs. Calderon or Dr. Calderon and others. There certainly is a similarity of ideas. Whether they derive them directly from Saad or not, I don't know. But the ideas are basically similar in that there is no right and wrong. It's beyond good and evil. So it's Nietzschean, it's Saadian. It is, if not directly, basically a product of this whole tradition.
Thank you, Reverend.